Thanks for having me. My name is Ed Nguyen. I am a security researcher with Cisco Zalos. So show of hands, how many people are familiar with Cisco Zalos? Okay, so good. That's good. For anyone who's not, we're the security research and threat intelligence team at Cisco. So we're the team that's responsible for analyzing the threat landscape globally, identifying new trends, new threats that we're seeing, or evolutions to existing ones, ripping them apart, and then making sure that customers all around the world remain protected, pushing out detection and prevention content across all the different products within Cisco's security portfolio. So a little background on myself. I've been with Zalos for about 2 years, but I've spent about the past decade defending critical infrastructures. So I've worked in nuclear energy, I've worked in financial services, power generation, high tech, before coming over to more of a research role. So disclaimers, not a sales guy, not a marketing guy, not a product guy. If you have questions about malware or threats or some of the things we're seeing across the threat landscape, definitely your guy there. So I also love malware, that's kind of my thing. At Zalos, we all kind of have different things we focus on from a security research perspective. I focus a lot on malware, so tracking malware distribution campaigns, whether that's malicious spam campaigns we're seeing around the globe, or following advertising exploit kits that are using web as a vector to draw malware. So just to kind of give you an idea, why is this guy on stage and why should I listen to him? Here's some metrics about Cisco from a telemetry standpoint. So this is all the data that we have visibility into, which is really powerful in terms of being able to quickly identify when things change, regardless of the industry, regardless of geographic location, so we can quickly rip those threats apart, figure out how they work, and then push out protection to customers. So right now we have visibility into about 1.5 million unique malware samples per day. So that's huge. We're seeing an increase in the use of malware as a way to initially penetrate a target environment for the purposes of establishing a foothold so that then lateral movement and some of the more longer-term techniques can start to take place from an attacker's perspective. So when you talk about malware, there's a few different vectors that attackers are typically using to get malware into target organizations, right? Email. So right now we see about 600 billion emails per day. So when it comes to quickly identifying new mouse spam campaigns in the wild in near real time so that we can protect customers, that telemetry data is what allows us to do that. So right now we have about 250 dedicated security researchers at Zalos, one of the largest teams in the industry. And these are the folks with hands on keyboard that are 24/7, 365, all around the world, analyzing and monitoring so that when there's an outbreak or when there's a new campaign, we can very, very quickly identify it. So let's talk about some threats. I wanted to walk through some specific examples of some of the types of threats that we feel like organizations should be aware of because the potential impact of these sorts of attacks is very, very high and it can have a significant impact in an organization very, very quickly. I wanted to start out by talking about supply chain attacks. So we've seen a marked uptick in this sort of an attack over the past 12 to 18 months. So, right, supply chain attacks. What are supply chain attacks? So at the end of the day, supply chain attacks are where an attacker will attempt to abuse the trust relationship between the organization and the providers of its hardware or software. Right, when you think about it from an organization's perspective, I'm sure everyone is practicing great patch management, grabbing updates from vendors as soon as they're released and ensuring that security vulnerabilities are patched in their environments. Well, supply chain attacks are all about exploiting that inherent trust that an organization has with the providers of those software updates, of those software applications, of the hardware that they're procuring to achieve the organization's mission objective. They're very, very dangerous because it's very difficult to proactively defend against these sort of attacks. And since you're typically, not necessarily at a code level vetting a lot of the code that gets introduced into your environment, it can be very difficult to spot until an attacker's already compromised the organization. So there have been a few examples of this. So the NetGear or NotPetya cyber attack that had a significant impact in Ukraine last year was a supply chain attack. So the attackers had compromised the update servers for a specific tax accounting software firm that if you do business in Ukraine, you probably have this package installed in your environment because it's essentially how you're able to successfully do business there. So by compromising those update servers, attackers were able to push malware in the form of a malicious software update to that software in organizations. And that was in that case, it was a destructive worm. So it quickly propagated laterally within the environment and had a significant impact to a lot of organizations around the world. So I want to talk about a different supply chain attack because I think this one's interesting as well. So at one point last year, we were actually beta testing a brand new exploit detection capability in one of our products, And we were seeing a specific executable that kept getting flagged as malicious. And we started to look at it, and it was actually the binary that was associated with Piriform's CCleaner software. So if you're not familiar with CCleaner, a company named Piriform came out with this application, and it essentially provides a centralized place where you can perform various Windows care and feeding. So think updating software, cleaning temporary files, things like that. Just kind of some of the care and feeding that a lot of folks do on their systems. So Piriform was actually acquired by an antivirus company called Avast, and they're continuing to release this particular application. But what was interesting about us flagging on this executable was that when we actually went and started taking a look at it, we identified that it was actually downloaded from the legitimate distribution servers that Avast was using to distribute CCleaner. And so we started ripping it apart. You know, it was a valid executable. It was being downloaded from the legitimate source repository that Avast has for their official releases of the software. But why were we, analyzing it in the first place? Why was our software flagging as malicious? So we started to take a look at it, and we found that it was actually a backdoor version of the CCleaner application that was being distributed using legitimate means. So there were a couple interesting things about this particular case. So we started to look at the executable itself, and we found that it had been signed using a legitimate code signing certificate or Piriform. So that was really interesting. We also found a compilation artifact present in this particular executable that, and these different pieces of information are kind of indicative that there's a larger issue, or there was at the time a larger issue with the overall software development environment. Right, so backdoors had been inserted into this code before it was signed by a legitimate manufacturer, and probably before it was compiled from source code before they shipped this version of CCleaner in the first place. So obviously we notified Avast, but we started to take a look to see if we could identify what functionality was available. What is the whole purpose or point of this particular malware? What's it trying to do in target organizations? And we found some interesting characteristics. So in this particular case, the malware had a delay tactic. So think about a lot of organization security. They'll take files that come into their environment, and in a lot of cases they have sandboxing technology. So executable comes into the environment, it gets pushed automatically into a virtual environment, detonated to see if it's malicious or not. In this particular case, they built in a routine because, if your sandbox is set to run an executable for 5 minutes and the delay is for 5.5 minutes, it's going to look completely benign, but in all reality, it's still malicious. So we also saw that this particular malware would check to see if the infected user had administrative rights on the system before it would run further. That's fairly common. But one of the other things is that we saw it gathering what's called survey information, so think various information about the infected system so that it can be communicated back to the attacker's command and control server infrastructure. So just to kind of give you an idea of the sort of information that was being collected, this is just a subset, think computer name, operating system version, in this particular case, patch levels, every installed application, every running process on the system. Pretty much anything a bad guy would need to be able to fully test a second stage payload to ensure that it wouldn't be detected in your environment, right? They know all the security stack you're running, they know what versions of Windows patches are installed on an endpoint that they already have access to, and this allows them to get a really good understanding of your defenses so that they can custom craft later stage payloads specifically designed to circumvent those. So that was all communicated back to the attacker as part of what I'll call stage one, or the backdoor code that was present in the CCleaner binary itself. So this kind of shows what the command and control process looks like. They kind of custom created their own command and control protocol, but essentially at a high level, the way this worked was the malware would attempt to connect to a hard-coded IP address that the attacker controlled. In cases that it wasn't able to establish a TCP connection or network connection with that hard-coded IP, what it would do is it would actually generate a second stage, a dynamically generated list of domains. It would perform a DNS request to those domains, and then the results of those DNS requests, there would be a cryptographic routine performed on to generate the actual new backup command control server IP address. So pretty interesting, pretty robust and resilient way to build this sort of a command and control process. But one problem, they didn't actually register any of the DGA domains, so we were able to do that to sinkhole the traffic so that they wouldn't be able to control any of the nodes that they had infected once that primary IP address was taken down. So we basically sinkholed all of those domains, and it made sure that the DNS, when you perform that whole process on it, would always return our sinkhole IP address, thus correcting the malware there. So we contacted Avast, obviously. Anytime we're in a situation like this, we always, you know, communicate privately with the affected organizations so that they can fix the problems so the internet's a safer place. But we started to monitor activity to those domains that we had previously registered just to kind of get an idea of the scope of this infection. So if you're familiar with CCleaner, you know it's used very extensively in a lot of organizations. On their website, you know, they boast millions of downloads that take place at this particular application. So the implications of all of these systems being infected is pretty bad. So we can see we weren't getting a whole lot of traffic for July and into August. But in September, we identified that the primary IP address that these systems were designed to communicate out with had been taken down, which resulted in all of the infected systems all around the world starting to hit our sinkhole, meaning that the attacker no longer had access to them, no longer had the capability to control them. So what was interesting was we were actually given a copy of the command and control server image that the attacker was using, which gave us access to the web application that they were running to manage communications with infected systems, but it also gave us the back-end MySQL database they were using to store all of the survey information they had been collecting. And what we found was that it was a pretty simple PHP application, but it was interesting because they actually had an array called domain list. And what they would do is, as part of the survey information, they would grab what the originating domain associated with an infected system was. And if it was in this list, a second stage payload was dropped onto the system. If it wasn't on this list of domains, then nothing further would happen. They would simply keep the survey information and not drop any additional malware. So very, very targeted as far as, you know, who was actually delivered the longer-term second stage payload. You can see Cisco.com is actually listed in this array. So if a system within Cisco had happened to communicate with this command and control server because an infected version of CCleaner was installed on the system, they would drop a second stage payload. You can also see a couple domains in that list that are very, very relevant to this industry. So we did confirm that we didn't have a single device that actually had any survey information stored in the MySQL database. I imported the database and started querying it to look to see, you know, what sorts of organizations had been impacted, what sorts of industries had been impacted. It was global, it was all around the world. We saw a ton of infected systems in a lot of different critical infrastructure and a lot of different industries in general. So we also started to do some high-level code analysis to determine if we had seen any of the code that was used in this particular malware elsewhere within the threat landscape. You know, were there any functions that maybe we had seen before in some unrelated security incident or any sort of malware family that we had already been tracking? And what we identified was that there was potential code reuse and a decent amount of it. You can see the similarities in the code constructs on the screenshot to malware that we had seen associated with an APT that we refer to as Group 72. So Group 72 goes by a bunch of different names depending on what vendor you're talking to, but if you go Google that that particular threat actor, which you'll find is a lot of different media articles and news articles referring to this particular adversary. So it just goes to show some of the threats that we're facing and how sophisticated they are. As organizations continue to increase and improve their security postures, attackers are finding those weak links. So from an organizational perspective, when you're selecting software vendors to use for applications in your environment, you know, it's very, very important to ensure that they're an established organization and quantitatively prove that they take security of their environment as serious as yours, right? Because you can be secure all day long, but if the providers you're using for solutions that are running within your organization aren't, that's the weak link. And attackers know that. They're starting to perform these sorts of attacks with an increased frequency over the past, like I said, 12 to 18 months. So another threat that I wanted to talk about that we've seen kind of an increase in over the past 12 months is what I'll refer to as destructive worms. So think worms that are designed purely to destroy information or systems within an organization's environment. When combined with supply chain attacks, like what we saw with NotPetya last year, they can be very, very damaging. And because they're self-replicating, that damage can occur within an environment and it can spread within that environment very, very quickly. So I want to talk about one of the more recent examples of a particular malware family that we identified that Its sole goal was to destroy a system within an environment that was being targeted, and its sole purpose was to do that as quickly as possible. And we named this one Olympic Destroyer. So if you've been following the news around the Winter Olympics, you know that sometime during early February, over a weekend period, there was a Guardian publication that referred to some operational disruption that had been encountered during the Winter Olympics. And there was some question as to whether or not that disruption was related to some sort of a cyber attack. Well, we started to go through all the telemetry data that we had visibility into, closed source, open source, pretty much all the things, to see if we could identify any sort of characteristics or a particular malware sample that may be associated with this particular attack. And we did. We found a malware sample, which we dubbed Olympic Destroyer. And this was an example of a destructive worm. So there were a few interesting characteristics of this particular malware compared to some of the other destructive malware families that we've seen in the wild, so I want to kind of point some of them out. So in this particular case, I'll spare you a lot of the technical details, but in this particular case, the attackers had chosen to provide the capability to propagate or move laterally within an organization through multiple means. So they had rolled, if you're familiar with the SysInternal suite for Microsoft, they had rolled PSExec in with the malware. So PSExec is not malware, it's a utility that tons of legitimate system administrators use to manage large numbers of Windows systems. And they were using that to attempt to authenticate to other systems from the initially infected one, and if they could, roll the malware out to that system, execute it, and rinse and repeat. But they also leveraged WMI, which is native functionality available within Windows. And so the way this works is they were basically, the initially infected system in the environment would scan its own subnet, its own network, to see if there were any other candidates for propagation. If there were, they would attempt to use PSExec or WMI to propagate that malware to the other systems that were good candidates for infection. And that's interesting because, you know, even in highly segmented environments, there are a few Windows-specific protocols that are typically always allowed on the internal firewalls, right? When you talk about SMB, WMI, the things that PSExec use, those are normal flows of traffic within most corporate environments, with most environments where you have domain controllers communicating to Windows endpoints, where you have Windows endpoints communicating to file servers, things like that. So even in highly segmented environments, this sort of propagation would still work. So this was an interesting malware family in general. So in this particular case, it was modular. So when I talk about modular malware, what that means is there's a main module that runs all the time, but then there's all these secondary pieces of functionality that get run autonomously and then feed data back to that main module. So in this particular case, they had a browser stealer, which would facilitate the dumping of credentials from all major web browsers installed in the systems. I think Microsoft Edge, Google Chrome, Firefox. They also had system stealer, but that was basically like a version of Mimikatz. Long story short, it allows an attacker to dump Windows credentials from memory. They would also cache the original executable, and I'll kind of go into that in a little more detail. But then there was the destroyer module, and that's the module that was responsible for the destruction of systems within the environment. And then obviously, I mentioned earlier, they rolled PSExec in with this particular malware. So the password stealer, it would basically go through all of the credential caches associated with all major browsers installed in the system, grab those credentials, and communicate them back to the main module. Then the system stealer, it's like Mimikatz. It's not the actual Mimikatz utility. It was a custom created version, but just to kind of understand the functionality, it's very, very similar. It would basically dump credentials from within memory on the Windows system that was infected and then communicate that back to the main module. What was really, really interesting here, so we've seen the Mimikatz-like functionality before, we've seen PSExec before, but what they would do is they would take all of the credentials that were compromised using the browser credentials and using the system credentials, and they would basically insert those into the binary in memory to create a new binary that was customized for the environment in which they were operating. We don't see that very often. We've seen the hard code lists of commonly used usernames and passwords. We've seen things like that, but in this particular case, every single system that you run this particular malware on would have credentials embedded into the binary, and then the binary would be resaved out to disk, and that's what would be used to propagate across the environment. So no two systems with the same credentials stored in the binary as possible. That's very interesting, because even if someone has zero compromised credentials within the environment that they're infecting, they're able to quickly build a credential set based off of the credentials that they specifically gathered from the infected systems. So it shows some increased sophistication, and we've kind of seen this trend where we've seen a lot of, you know, kind of destructive and ransomware-based worms over the past 12 months. Think WannaCry, think Nietia, think BadRabbit, Home Destroyer. We've kind of seen an increase in the sophistication and sorts of techniques that they're using to allow them to operate more effectively and more efficiently within organizations that they compromise. So the Destroyer functionality. So this is basically the functionality that was responsible for disrupting operations within environments that this malware infected. So the first thing they would do is they would delete shadow copies. That's pretty common. They would also delete backup catalogs on the infected system itself. One thing that was interesting was rather than wiping files stored on the endpoint, they would check for map shared drives, something like file servers, and that's what they would actually wipe in this particular case. So they would wipe data that had been mapped in the form of network shares, things like that. So one of the other interesting things that they did was they disabled the ability to boot into recovery mode within Windows. So that makes it much, much more difficult to try to recover from this sort of an attack. They wiped all of the event logs, which makes forensic analysis much, much more difficult. One of the other interesting things they did was they would disable all the Windows services on the system. So when you think about it, if you're running a SQL server for database functionality, or if you're running a domain controller in particular, they don't respond too well when you start willy-nilly disabling services. In this particular case, they went through the entire service list on every system, and they set all of the startup modes to disable, so that when the system was rebooted, no services would be available, including the core Windows services required for boot time. And then, as I mentioned, in the case of a domain controller, all the directory services were disabled. And it's pretty difficult without backups that function effectively to really start to quickly recover from these sorts of attacks. And given that this was automatically moving laterally within the environment, you can see how this would pose a large problem very, very quickly. It starts out with one infected system, and then 5 minutes later, you've got 50. So right, who wasn't responsible for Olympic Destroyer? So shortly after we came out with the research on this particular malware family, there were a lot of folks in the industry that were very, very quick to point the blame to a lot of different people. So we decided, you know, okay, some people were blaming X, some people were blaming Y. But we decided to kind of take a look at some of the links that people were drawing to see if they were legitimate, if they were strong enough to really point the finger in one way. Well, we found that there were artifacts present within the malware that looked very similar to some that we've seen from Lazarus Group. I won't go through all of the specific examples, but okay, so we've got some interesting characteristics that look very similar to what we've seen from this particular APT group. Okay, well, we also had some artifacts within this malware that looked very, very similar to a completely separate APT group. And these are all just based on analysis of the malware samples themselves. Okay, well, was it the same actor associated with Nietia? Well, there were also some artifacts that we found that were very similar to what we had seen with Nietia. So you've got Lazarus Group, you've got another APT group, you've got another APT group, and we're seeing all of these, I'll call them flags, present within the malware to attempt to make it look like it was one group versus another group versus another group that was actually responsible for this attack. We also found an Eternal Romance trace within this particular malware. So if you're not familiar, Eternal Romance was a publicly disclosed exploit that targeted a vulnerability in Microsoft Windows that's been increasingly implemented or integrated with a bunch of different malware over the past 12 to 18 months. So we would see them build the elements associated with Eternal Romance in memory, but they never actually called any code responsible for implementing that, which was pretty interesting. So here you can kind of see the code out of GitHub responsible for this. It looks a little different in memory, but you could definitely see it. So here's a tweet from the Windows Defender Security Intelligence Group, where they announced that they had actually detected usage of the Eternal Romance SCP exploit. And that was on February 13th. We were super interested in that. We started contacting them. We were like, did we miss something? We saw this, but we never saw it actually used. And then on the 14th, they redacted that because they also agreed that although there were artifacts, there was no evidence that the exploit was ever actually called following the code execution below the malware. So just a final class here. I definitely want to point out, you know, when you're talking about doing simple code reuse analysis or simply going off of the data that's present within a malware sample itself, it's extremely difficult to have a high level of confidence when attributing an attack to a specific threat actor. It's very, very trivial for a malware author to insert what I call false flags into the particular malware sample to make it look like it is someone else. It's very, very trivial to do, and in a lot of cases within industry, what we find is that people are very, very quick to draw these conclusions based on very, very surface level information. Nowadays, I think the only way to really attribute these sort of attacks is to combine what you get from analyzing a particular malware sample along with other sources. So think human, additional signals intelligence, things like that to really be able to attribute attacks nowadays. It's not feasible to consider the information that the malware author is readily giving you in the form of a sample, any sort of a really high level of confidence indicator. So this attack could have been a lot worse if combined with supply chain attacks like the one that I described earlier. You know, it could have had a significant widespread impact on a large number of environments simultaneously. And we've seen the effects of these sort of self-replicating attacks. WannaCry had a significant impact on a lot of organizations. NotPetya had a significant impact targeted to a specific geographic region, in that case, Ukraine. So we've seen this. And it's really important that organizations understand that attackers are increasingly using these sorts of attacks to target organizations, target industries, target geographic regions for a variety of different mission objectives. So attackers are going to continue to copy each other, right? Anytime, even if you're a legitimate organization, you ask a developer who may not necessarily be super familiar with a particular programming language to do X in that programming language, what's the first thing they typically do? They go out to the internet to see if there's any code already available that solves their problem for them. I mean, attackers do the same thing. Why reinvent the wheel if you don't have to? And I mentioned earlier that attribution based solely from malware samples is not accurate. So just one of the things that we do at Cisco, at Talos, is we try to put as much research-related information out into the public space as possible so that, you know, organizations, not just Cisco customers, but the entire world, can stay up to date and stay informed when it comes to a lot of the security research that we're doing on a day-in, day-out basis. So there's a list of resources there. I highly recommend checking out the Talos blog. Anytime we come across a new attack that we see in the wild that we feel like organizations should know about, we've always published extensive research blogs there, including indicator compromise data, write-ups about how the threat works, how it can impact organizations. We also, not too long ago, started a new podcast. It's a security research kind of information security podcast. It's called Beers with Talos. So highly recommend that one as well if you want to stay up to date on, you know, what we're seeing from a training perspective. And with that, if anyone has any questions, I can take them now, or feel free to see me in the break.
We have a question right here. Hang on.
Appreciating the difficulty in attribution, are there certain indicators that are more, that you have more confidence in as opposed to others that give you a higher degree of confidence?
It's kind of a case-by-case scenario. You know, a lot of it's based on the information that we have about a specific threat in the wild. If you only have a malware sample, you know, I mean, it's really easy to fake a lot of that stuff.
You have a question up front?
A simple question. I was curious, you used the Windows example. What about iOS, Android, Linux, Macintosh, whatever? I mean, is this pretty much universal? You see the same techniques used in other operating systems, or in set-top box for that matter?
So embedded systems are just Linux systems, right? They're typically just like either ARM or, you know, some other variant of Linux. At the end of the day, I do a lot of embedded security research work, and what you'll find is that there's a lot of the same stacks running across embedded systems. You know, embedded Linux distro with BusyBox implementation that facilitates a lot of the under-the-cover Linux operations. So as you know, there have been a large amount of IoT-related compromise on embedded systems. So think, ARM or systems like that, ARM, MIPS architecture systems, because at the end of the day, they're just Linux. A lot of people like to think about embedded systems as like a super special like thing, but I analyzed a lot of embedded systems, and at the end of the day, they're just Linux. When you talk about IoT botnets, like Mirai and some of the others that we've seen, it's readily apparent that there's vulnerabilities present, and if vulnerabilities are there and exploitable, they're going to be targeted. And in a lot of cases, from an attacker's perspective, when you think specific to like IoT or embedded devices, what's the perfect place to maintain long-term persistence? Probably someone's thermostat, right? I can't tell you the last time I actually woke up on a Saturday and decided, I should check to see if my Nest has been owned, right? Embedded devices are increasingly becoming a target attack for a lot of attackers.
Awesome. Final question. Do you go to a beard shop or you trim it home?
What's up?
Go to a beard shop or you trim it home?
It kind of depends. if I need a real cleanup, then yeah, beard shop.
All right, they're a mystery to me, obviously, with my coffee. Edmund, thank you so much.